IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast supported by Pragati, a flagship media initiative of the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like to bring fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and an Indian perspective to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat.
Hello and welcome to today's episode of All Things Policy. Before we begin, I will just like to mention that admissions are now open for our 12-week graduate certificate program in Public Policy, Defense and Foreign Affairs, Technology and Policy, and Health and Life Sciences. The application deadline is 28th August and the cohort begins on 1st September. It is all online and you can take it from anywhere. To know more, visit takshashila.org.in/courses. For more details. So now coming to today's episode, I'm Amira Rao, and to discuss Japan's latest defense white paper, I have with me my colleagues Aditya Parikh and Suyash Desai. Here at Takshashila, Suyash is a PLA and China watcher, and Aditya, apart from Kremlin watching, tracks the unique bilateral relationship between Russia and Japan. So welcome guys to today's episode.
Thank you, Amira.
Thanks, Amira.
So I want to talk about the defense white paper of Japan. And the first thing I want to ask is that it mentions certain aspects of Chinese military and security. And what is the general impact of this on the broader Indo-Pacific security? Suyash, I'll start with you.
Thanks, Amira, for having me. So Japan's white paper is very specific. It starts with China. There are three main aspects that the white paper highlights in the summary itself. One is regarding the Chinese coercion through its maritime militia and coast guards. Apart from PLA, these two things are majorly focused in the white paper. Second, it talks about Russia. And third, it talks about North Korean nuclear North Korea. So these are the three things that are very important from Japan's security point of view. It dwells into a lot of aspects like partnership, alliances, and how does that matter to Indo-Pacific region, it's Japan's Indo-Pacific approach. So in case of alliances, it talks about the transition and change in US presidency and how Japan sees at this transition and change and how it affects the US-Japan alliance. So for example, in 2020, there were a lot of activities by Chinese maritime militia and coast guard in the South China Sea and East China Sea. And the United States of America changed its approach to the region under President Trump. However, and Japan's white paper, defense white paper, claims that there is a continuity in the transition even after President Biden came to power. And that is something that Japan is looking forward to. So approach has not changed after the change of presidency, and that is something that Japan cares about. Partnership, there is a lot about partnership. There is something about partnership with India as well. So broadly, Japanese partners are Australia, South Korea, up to an extent India, which has a major role to play in the Indo-Pacific, though more into IOR, but also in broader Indo-Pacific region. So the white paper dwells upon how these partnerships have been played out in the past and will play out in the future. The white paper also talks about Japanese defense systems, Japanese defense capabilities, and US capabilities. White paper also mentions Taiwan, but we'll come to Taiwan at the end because that's a different concept altogether. So broadly, if I have to sum up the white paper in 2-3 lines, the white paper says that there is an increase in the spike. China, US are at a loggerheads with each other. Tensions are increasing in the Indo-Pacific region. Japan is preparing the capability as a result of this tension to prepare itself for this tension. And alliances and partnerships will go a long way for credible deterrence. White paper doesn't use words like credible deterrence, but it is implied because Chinese themselves have developed a capability which cannot be balanced by any single country. That's why credible deterrence could already be established if there is a stronger emphasis on alliances and partnerships. If you have to sum up the white paper in one, this is something alliances and partnership in the Indo-Pacific region. That is something the white paper implicitly argues.
So, apart from being a Quad partner, Japan and its strategic weight in the Indo-Pacific or Asia-Pacific region is a formidable force. Any strategic publication that may give us a glance into the Japanese MOD, self-defense forces, and their national security priorities is important for us to discuss. So, on that note, the defense paper also makes mention of the close security and military cooperation between Russia and China. So how valid is this threat perception for Japan that its adversaries would throw down their combined might against it? Aditya?
I'm glad you asked that, Amira. So let me start with adding something to what Suyash just talked about. So it's important to note, to first of all, the cover of the defense white paper. So there's been a lot of talk about how it signals a kind of belligerent or more ready to shoulder the security burden in the Indo-Pacific in terms of taking more responsibility on the part of Japan. So you see a horseman on a galloping horse in a belligerent stance. So that is pretty reflective of how Japan is going to approach its security cooperation with its allies in the Indo-Pacific. So I think it's a sign that they're going to take up more responsibility. Another indicator is that very recently, I think a month or so ago, the defense minister of Japan, Nobuo Kishi, he mentioned that Japan is looking to break from the 1% to GDP limit on Japan's defense budget. So they're not going to adhere to it anymore, and they're going to invest more in their military. And this would be across domains, across services. For example, the helicopter destroyers that Japan fields, the Izumo and her sister ships, and the older helicopter destroyers, they're going to be converted into proper aircraft carriers, which can carry, I think, 6 to 8 F-35Bs, which Japan is in the process of acquiring right now. So these are some indicators that I also wanted to mention about the Indo-Pacific. So coming to your question about the joint cooperation between Russia and China, so the defense white paper also makes mention of the close security and military cooperation between Russia and China. But let me say that there are a few aspects to this. So the Japanese Minister of State for Defense, Nakayama Yoshihide, he's spoken about increasing close cooperation between the People's Republic of China and Russia over military and security issues very recently at a Hudson Institute event. Now, there was another statement by the Deputy Defense Minister, Taro Aso. So he's a very different person. He's a Deputy Defense Minister, and this is the Minister of State for Defense. So two different individuals have made a similar statement. But I'll come to Taro Aso's statement later. So the joint cooperation between China and Russia is seen as some sort of a threat to Japan and US both jointly, and other Indo-Pacific allies who are threatened by this cooperation, who feel threatened by this cooperation. So for the moment, this has been materialized, that we can see tangibly, by the joint bomber flights between PRC's H-6 bombers and Russia's Bear bombers. They conduct joint sorties in the Sea of Japan, which, obviously, Japanese fighter aircraft to intercept. And, it's chalked up as another instance where Japan sees a threat when Russia and China conflate their interests against it. So this is a nightmarish scenario for them. Another thing about Nobuo Kishi I want to mention is that he visited an airbase in Chitose City, Hokkaido, which is the largest island of Japan. So that airbase provides the interception fighter flights against Russian aircraft who approach from the north. So there he gave a speech saying that Russian military activity around Japan can't be overlooked, even if China is the bigger threat. So it would be a folly to ignore Russian capabilities. And the reports in Japanese media that were carrying this statement from the speech, they gave very specific numbers. So the total fighter sorties by Japanese air self-defense forces was 725 times Japanese fighter aircraft were scrambled, 458 times in response to approaching Chinese aircraft, and 258 times in response to approaching Russian aircraft. So that's almost 36% of the sorties conducted in response to Russian activities alone. So Russia is in no uncertain terms a smaller adversary. It is just as important, in my opinion, and the numbers reflect that it is at least 36% of the total threat for the air self-defense forces. So, you know, in aggregate, the true nightmarish scenario for Japan would be when China and Russia conflate their interests and present a joint front against Japan. So the defense white paper mentions about the Senkaku and Kuril Islands dispute. So now imagine how Chinese vessels are at the moment intruding into waters along the Senkakus quite regularly. So I think about 156 days or so has been the highest number until now when Chinese vessels have intruded into the Senkaku's sphere. So a similar thing happens to the Russian ships end up in the same waters, what then? So if the issue of Senkakus and Kurils are conflated by a PRC and Russia, it would be the true nightmarish scenario which Japan really would have no hope of escaping. Yeah, I think that's my answer.
That's very interesting, Aditya, that you brought Senkakus and DIUs into the equation. Because I was just reading the white paper. In the white paper, there is an interesting table that they have mentioned. So since China declared EDIs, air defense identification zone, earlier last decade, the white paper mentions the number of sorties as well as the number of times the Chinese maritime militia and coast guards were in the Japanese waters. So that is something very interesting statistic that they are given. So that's very interesting that the core of the dispute has been alive for so long, and there has been spike over a past decade or so.
Yeah, and I'd also like to mention something about the Taiwan issue that has recently come up with Japan pledging at least the Deputy Defense Minister Taro Aso and the Minister of State for Defense, both in different events, saying that how Japan needs to defend Taiwan as a democracy if China threatens it. So this has the potential to become a major flashpoint between Beijing and Tokyo. Although until now, it has been just about words. But when push comes to shove, how do we prepare for that? So we only have evidence and trends to analyze, you know? And a lot of things point to Japan being more gung-ho and shouldering a lot of burden in any Indo-Pacific security alliance, may it emerge or not emerge from the Quad.
No, interestingly, Japan's in the white paper, Japan says a lot about Taiwan. So how capabilities could be improved, how deterrence can be established, what would be Japan's role? This is again implicit, what would be Japan's role if there is a reunification that happens, peaceful or not peaceful? So how would Japan support the United States of America? Would it support the United States of America? What would be US role, and how US's role will define how Japan will play its card during Taiwan reunification? These are the interesting aspects that have been highlighted in the defense white paper. And I'm not surprised they are highlighted, because if you see the discourse over past 6 to 8 months, Different minister, you yourself brought it out that Japanese defense minister had on several occasions pointed out how Taiwan's independence or Taiwan being a natural barrier is very important for Japan. So I'm not surprised that this was highlighted, but I'm just surprised at the detail and in which that they have discussed Taiwan is something very interesting. Also, China has responded to this, obviously. China has responded to this in their MFA press conferences, where they have claimed that Taiwan is obviously a regular thing. Taiwan is an integral part of China, and no other country in their white paper or otherwise would say anything about Taiwan. So let's see how these events turn out in the future.
So now I want to talk a little bit more about Russia specifically. And in that case, what in the paper, in the defense paper, what are the main highlights in terms of threat perception and emerging domains of warfare?
Okay, so specifically about Russia, there's a bunch of stuff, but there's a lot of repetition. So from the white paper itself and from some more recent commentary by Japanese leaders, I gathered that the issues of note are, Russia's focus on the modernization of weaponry that they've deployed there, including the development of hypersonic weapons. It also, the white paper, it also acknowledges the increased activity by Russian military in the Russian Far East and on the Kuril Islands. There have been an absolute insane amount of military exercises by Russia in 2020-2021. So with very little time between them. So the Russian Navy was about to conduct missile drills right in the exclusive economic zone of Japan a few weeks back. And this is completely legal under UNCLOS. And they'd informed the Japanese about it. And well, under UNCLOS, as long as you pay due regard to the security and prosperity of the state in whose easy you are conducting military drills, it's completely legal. But this is something that we Indians would not really take or swallow very easily. As we saw with the FONOPS operation with USS John Paul Jones. So Japan, well, let me say that those drills were cancelled at the very last moment. But it remains a distinct possibility that Russia is going to push the military exercises a lot more even in this coming year. And another priority that I saw in the defense white paper was Japan talking about the electronic warfare and unmanned aerial vehicles that Russia has developed and is deploying in its Far East region and the Kuril Islands. So I remember a few months back, the Japanese defense ministry had published data on how in 2017, Orlan UAVs and LIR-3 electronic warfare system was deployed on the Kuril Islands by the Russian military. And this UAV and this electronic warfare system, when they work in conjunction, can even block cell phone signals in the area. So they have a pretty good electronic warfare capability on the Kuril Islands and the Russian Far East. And also the air defense systems. So S-300V4 was deployed on the Kuril Islands. Very recently, that's the most recent version of the S-300 system. And there's an S-400 system deployed on Sakhalin, which is very close to the Kurils as well, and Russian territory. So both of these systems in conjunction can shoot down anything airborne in the Sea of Japan, I'd say. So anything that would be threatening the Russian Far East and the Kurils. So Russia's pretty much covered in terms of air defense, I think. So these are some things that Japan is really paying attention to.
And finally, has there been any reaction by Russia or Russian officials to this white paper?
I think the most clear reactions have been on Twitter, honestly. I haven't really seen a proper press release until yet. Maybe I've missed one. So the Russian embassy in Japan has tweeted twice, one this morning. So one was right after the defense white paper came out. Both of those times, the Russian embassy in Japan was talking about how Japan's claims on the Kuril Islands are unacceptable to them. So and how the Kurils are an inseparable part of Russia and our Russian territory as a result of World War II. So Japan has sometimes been seen as this revisionist country who tries to deny the Soviet gains from the Great Patriotic War. So sometimes the territorial dispute is seen from this lens, from the Russian side. Russia does not see Japan as an adversary exactly, I'd say, but is rather suspicious of it because of the close cooperation in terms of military and security issues it has with the US. So Russia has many concerns, some of them objectively hard to overlook, even as an independent analyst. Say, like the US's plan to deploy precision strike missiles on Japanese territory under the Pacific Deterrence Initiative that can target Russian territory too. Japan's cooperation about the Aegis air defense systems with the US. The possibility that if Kuril Islands were ever returned to Japan, the US military will build bases on them and be in a position to threaten the Russian Far East and Russia's access to the Pacific. And this morning, even while wishing the Japanese for the successful opening of the Tokyo Olympics, the Russian embassy in Japan has tweeted, and let me quote the tweet, with the opening coming up, we would like to express congratulations to the organizers and sincerely wish them the success for the games. On the other hand, we must once again call attention to the facts that the Southern Kuril Islands are an inseparable part of the territory of the Russian Federation. So that is putting extra emphasis on something that they've already covered. So I think that has been the official reaction.
Okay, so on that note, thank you Suyash and Aditya for joining me on this episode.
Thanks, Amira.
It's a pleasure, Amira.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM Podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is at IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle at TakshashilaInst or our website takshashila.org.in.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week, Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank, and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.